You hear me? Honorable Simon, can you hear me? Honorable Gondwe, can you hear me?
I can hear you, Chair. Good morning.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Welcome. So I would have spoken and not knowing that we've got a technical problem. I'd already done the welcome to everybody in the meeting. It's now at the point of inviting Advocate Mayosi, who will be taking us through today. I did indicate that we're using today as a last day to wrap up the committee sessions that we have started, as I indicated on Friday. So I'm going to ask Advocate Mayosi again to restart. Over to you, Advocate Mayosi.
Thank you, Chair. Sepo, can you put up the motion, please? So members will recall that in the motion that the subject matter of the inquiry, it is alleged that the PP is guilty of misconduct in charge one in relation to the sub-CIX matter. So we're going to go through it fairly quickly because this is just for context, and the motion is already very familiar to members of the committee. So in charge two, she's alleged to have committed misconduct in relation to the Freddie Dairy matter. Incompetence is the charge in charge three in relation to the sub and the Freddie Dairy matters, as well as the FSCA matter. And then misconduct or incompetence are alleged in charge four. And that charge, which starts from paragraph 10 of the motion, encompasses a whole range of various issues. In paragraph 10, charge 4 includes some of the issues that Advocate Mbofu has often referred to broadly as the HR matters, and those are set out in paragraph 10. But charge 4 also includes in support of the misconduct and incompetence allegations. It includes allegations of a number of failures attributed to the PP, and these are set out in paragraph 11 onwards. Go down, Sepo. And they're set out in paragraphs 11.1 to 11.3, these various failures that it is alleged the PP committed. And then there's charge 4, which alleges that the PP deliberately sought, charge 11.4, suppose, just want to read that, which accuses the PP of misconduct / and or incompetence in relation to deliberately seeking to avoid making findings against or directing remedial action in respect of certain public officials while deliberately seeking to reach conclusions of unlawful conduct and impose far-reaching disciplinary measures and remedial action in respect of other officials, even where such conclusions and or measures and or remedial action manifestly had no basis in law or in fact. Members will also be aware that the motion was then supplemented by Ms. Mazzoni by means of a letter dated the 11th of December 2020, which was addressed to the chairperson of the independent panel. So can you go to page 11A of Title A for that letter? 11A, it should be after the motion. Yeah? So the motion ends on page 11, yeah, that's it, yeah. So that is the letter from Ms. Mazzoni to the chairperson of the independent panel, which sought to, just broadly speaking, supplement the motion. The purpose of the letter is stated in paragraph 2 by Ms. Mazzoni, who says that she hereby places before the independent panel further relevant written and recorded information pertaining to the charges contained in Annexure A to the notice of motion for the initiation of a Section 194 inquiry against the PP Advocate Mkhwebane, and she references the earlier date of the 25th of February 2020. She says all of the information is in the form of further orders and judgments that pertain to the PP and which were issued since my submission to the aforesaid notice of motion. I number the annexures in sequence to those referred to in the charges attached to the notice of motion. She, in paragraph four of her letter, she states that in relation to charges 2, 3, and 4, she attaches orders of the Supreme Court of Appeal and the Constitutional Court. She continues in that letter, and she says in paragraph 5 that with reference to charges 3 and 4, she attaches the documents, the judgment referred to in paragraph 5.1, and that is the judgment and order of the full court, of the full court in the High Court in the matter of the President versus the PP. Members will recall that that is the Busasa CR 17 matter, which Advocate Bawak covered in detail with the committee last week with reference to the evidence given by the PP. Ms. Mazzoni then also says that she places before the committee in relation to charges 3 and 4, the documents she describes in paragraph 5.2, which is the judgment and order of the High Court in the matter of Commissioner of SARS versus the PP. The judgment was delivered on the 23rd of March 2020, and it's annexed as Annexure 10A. And in that matter, the High Court ordered the Advocate Mkhwebane to pay 15% of the applicant's tax costs, day bonus, pro priis. It is this judgment, Chair, which I intend to deal with for the committee today as a context. It was handed down by Mabuse J in the North Gauteng Division of the High Court on the 23rd of March, as stated in the letter. Tsepo, you'll find that judgment in Bundle C, Folder 3, and it's Item 28. We'll go there in detail later. So I intend to delve into this judgment in greater detail. Suffice to say that for the purposes of this introduction, that the High Court, as alluded to by Ms. Mazzoni in her letter, granted the SARS commissioner the declaratory order that he sought, and he gave a costs order, Mabuse J gave a costs order against the PP personally to pay 15% of the commissioner's tax costs. Notably, Chair, the same costs order was made against the PP in the SARS so-called rogue unit matter, where the PP was held liable there too for costs personally, with her liability limited to 15% of the attorney and client costs, including the costs of two counsel, where two counsel was employed. Unlike the Mabuse J personal costs order that was made against the PP, the costs order in the SARS rogue unit matter was not overturned by the Constitutional Court. And the Constitutional Court there refused leave to appeal in its entirety when it was sought by the PP. But returning to this current matter, this judgment that I will delve into for the committee today, after the High Court judgment, in April 2020, the PP then launched an application for leave to appeal against the Mabuse J judgment, and she sought leave to appeal directly to the Constitutional Court in terms of Rule 19 of the rules of that court. The PP sought leave to appeal against both the costs order as well as the merits judgment of the High Court. The Constitutional Court then delivered its judgment on the 15th of December 2020. It was a unanimous judgment of the Constitutional Court. written for the court by Justice Madlanga. That's also in Panel C, but we'll get to that one later. We'll start with the High Court one now. So we mentioned this constitutional court judgment that was written by Madlanga, because in these proceedings, the PP has often placed reliance on the minority judgment of former Chief Justice Mogoeng Mogoeng in the Busasa CR17 matter. The Constitutional Court heard the Busasa CR17 matter on the 26th of November 2020, and judgment was handed down in that matter on the 1st of July 2021. So after the Justice Madlanga judgment. So in his minority judgment in the Busasa CR17 matter, former Chief Justice Mogoeng cited paragraph 43 from the Justice Madlanga judgment, and in these proceedings, the following paragraphs of the former Chief Justice Mogoeng judgment have often been cited and repeated by both the PP and Advocate Mbofu. I think Tsepo, we should go the Bundle C, Folder 3, Item 12. I want you to go to paragraph 198. Good. Thanks. So members, will recall where we are now is the minority judgment of former Chief Justice Mogoeng, and this paragraph is one of the paragraphs that should by now be quite familiar to members, because it's been referred to and relied upon and cited by both the PP and Advocate Mbofu in these proceedings. And here, the former Chief Justice addressed what he described as the magnification of the public protector's errors, and he said in paragraph 198, the following wisdom-laden words of caution by Madlanga J encapsulate the concern I have about the treatment of matters involving the public protector, Advocate Mkhwebane, particularly her findings and recommendations or remedial steps. Although the context was different, the message or principle is just as apposite and telling in all other cases. There, Madlanga J said, and here, Chair, the former Chief Justice cites a paragraph, in fact, various paragraphs, 42, 45, 43, I think, in the Madlanga judgment, and there he cites what Justice Madlanga said, where he said, there appears to be a developing trend of seeking personal cost orders in most, if not all, matters involving the public protector. Courts must be wary not to fall into the trap of thinking that the public protector is fair game for automatic personal cost awards, whether inadvertently or otherwise. The High Court judgments in the EFF versus Godan matter and in the instant matter are instances where the High Court fell into that trap. Justice Madlanga continued, as cited by the former Chief Justice, I voice these words of caution because of the disturbing frequency and regularity of applications for and awards of personal cost orders against the public protector. What is particularly disturbing is that it is clear that the applications and awards are not always justified. And then the former Chief Justice continued in paragraph 199 to refer to what to say that there is indeed a disturbing tendency by some of us to presumably, without intending undue harm or injustice, unduly magnify virtually every error of the public protector, real or mistakenly perceived. This is quite surprising because judges with more experience as practitioners before their elevation to the bench and with more years of service as judges than the 10 years minimum requirement as an advocate, or the mere fact of being a judge, regardless of how long, to be appointable as a public protector, have committed similar or more serious errors. We are not, and we are not as harsh on them, or should I say on ourselves, and rightly so. So I'm going to turn now and deal more fully with the SARS judgment, starting with the judgment of the High Court in order to place these often repeated paragraphs in the former Chief Justice Mogoeng's minority judgment in the proper context. So Tshepo, please go to bundle C, folder 3, item 28. Yes. So Chair, this judgment resulted from an application that was brought by the Commissioner for SARS against four respondents. Although there were four respondents that were cited, the only parties who actively participated in the litigation were the Commissioner and the Public Protector. The issue that was in dispute between the parties was described by the court in paragraph 3.3, go down, Sipo, page 1005, yeah, where the judge said the real issues of dispute between the parties in this application can be determined from the relief that the Commissioner seeks. Simply, the question is when faced with the subpoena issued by the Public Protector in terms of Section 74A of the Public Protector Act against him, may the Commissioner refuse to comply with the said subpoena and rely on the provisions of Section 671A and 691 of the Tax Administration Act? That was the question before the court. The subject matter of the litigation was a subpoena that was issued by the Public Protector to the Commissioner for SARS on the 21st of October 2019. And the essence of what the subpoena contained is set out in paragraph 4 of the judgment. It's up on page 1007. And there, the court says, on 21 October 2019, the Public Protector, acting in terms of the provisions of said Section 74A of the PPA, issued a subpoena to the current Commissioner for SARS. And the subpoena stated as follows, inter alia, you are hereby required to appear in person before the Public Protector at the Public Protector House, Hillcrest, in Pretoria on Wednesday, 13 November 2019 at 11 a.m. to give evidence or to produce any documents listed in paragraph 7 below in your possession or under your control, which has a bearing on the matter being investigated. It continued, please take notice that at the hearing, you'll be required to provide an explanation, give evidence and produce any relevant documentation which may be in your possession and or under your control, such as minutes of meetings, reports and our correspondence, which may have a bearing on the investigation, including but not limited to the extent of your involvement and participation relating to the matters under investigation. Paragraph 3, the PP told the Commissioner that he may be assisted and so on. In paragraph 4, she continued to say, please, you've gone too quickly, sir. Please take further notice that Section 11.3 of the PPA provides that any person who without just cause refuses or fails to comply with a direction or request under Section 7.4 or refuses to answer any question put to him her under that section or gives such a question, an answer which to his or her knowledge is false, or refuses to take the oath or make affirmation at the request of the PP in terms of section 7.6, shall be guilty of an offence. She told the commissioner in paragraph 5 that she will not grant without just cause any request for postponement of your appearance or extension for submission of an affidavit or any document unless such request is done in person on the submission day or appearance day before the PP. And in paragraph 6, she said, please note further that section 11.4 of the PBA Act provides that any person convicted of an offence in terms of the Act shall be liable to a fine not exceeding 40,000 or to imprisonment for a period not exceeding 12 months or to both such fine and such imprisonment. So, Chair, although the subject matter of the dispute was the subpoena that was issued on the 21st of October 2019, the events that preceded the issuing of that subpoena formed part of the factual matrix that was before the court, and the court set out those events from paragraph 5 of the judgment onwards. And the court said the events that led to the issue of the subpoena are common cause between the parties. Largely, they are unchallenged and represent the evidence of the commissioner and the first respondent being the PP. It is common cause that the issue between the parties involves a legal dispute. Either on 17 or 18 October 2018, the PP subpoenaed the then acting commissioner, Mark Kinghorn, to provide information. This subpoena may conveniently be referred to for the purposes of distinction as the 2018 subpoena. This 2018 subpoena reflects that it was purportedly issued following a complaint lodged with the public protector by Mr. Musi Maimane, the third respondent, against Mr. Zuma, the second respondent. Said complaint was based on a book titled President's Keepers by a certain author, Jacques Poe. The book seemingly advanced the allegation that during the first month of his presidency in 2009, the former president, Mr. Zuma, earned a salary as an employee of a company, Royal Securities CC, which was cited as the fourth respondent. As the 2019 subpoena reveals, the quotation from the book suggests that in 2010, a SARS auditor was unable to determine whether tax had been deducted from Mr. Zuma's salary and paid to SARS by Royal Security. What this essentially means is that inter alia, the obligation of the third party, Royal Security, to deduct pay-as-you-earn tax was an issue. Indeed, the 2018 subpoena explicitly required the deduction of the Royal Security payroll reconciliation for the tax year March 2009 to 28 February 2010. The court continued to set out the events as part of its account of the events that preceded the subpoena that formed the subject matter of the litigation. And it says that following the 2018 subpoena, SARS attended at the PP's head office on 5 November 2018. It was represented at this meeting by inter alia Mr. Wayne Broughton. The Office of the Public Protector was represented personally by the PP and her team. At that meeting, SARS explained that the 2018 subpoena attempted to elicit evidence which, in terms of the Tax Administration Act, qualified as taxpayer information. Furthermore, SARS explained that the TAA precludes the production of such information and that the public protector was not one of the entities identified in Chapter 6 of the TAA. It is only in respect of the entities enumerated in the said Chapter 6 that the applicable taxpayer confidentiality provision may be relaxed under the TAA. Notwithstanding the said explanation, the public protector rejected SARS's explanation of how the TAA, especially Section 691 thereof, operates. Thereupon, and in a genuine attempt to break the impasse between them, SARS accordingly invited the PP to obtain a court order confirming her understanding of the law. PP refused to do so and raised financial constraints as a reason. She contended that her office was financially under-resourced and thereby implied that it could not afford approaching this court or even procuring legal advice vindicating her version. In response, SARS proposed that the parties should jointly seek legal advice, and SARS undertook to fund the bill for such legal opinion. The PP accepted the proposition, and on the 14th of November 2018, officials representing the PP on the one hand and SARS on the other hand met to finalize a joint brief to council. It was agreed between the PP and SARS that Cliff Dekker-Hoffmeyr should be appointed jointly in order to instruct counsel, although it's not so stated in the papers. I must assume that the issue on which counsel's opinion was sought was also identified at this meeting. It continued that on the 6th of December 2018, the officials from the PP's office and SARS consulted with the instructing attorneys and requested the attorneys to recommend and instruct counsel. From a list of recommended counsel, SARS and the public protector agreed to brief Advocate Maneti SC and Advocate Ferreira to provide them with a legal opinion on the topic that had been appropriately identified and selected by both parties. The topic jointly established by both parties and on which counsel's legal opinion was sought was to advise whether there is any means by which the PP and the South African Revenue Service can approach a court for relief that would allow the PP to subpoena tax information from SARS. In their report, the two counsel pointed out that we're instructed that SARS and the PP are of the view that there's a conflict between, one, the PPA, which gives the PP the power to obtain evidence which has a bearing on a matter being investigated, and two, the TAA, which prohibits the disclosure of SARS confidential information. The judge said that there was therefore no doubt, nor was there any dispute as to what counsel were expected to do. So what then happened is that during March 2019, Advocate Maneti SC and Advocate Ferreira duly produced their opinion dated March 2019. Their opinion correctly records on its cover sheet that the opinion had been prepared for the PP and for SARS. SARS accepted that it is in the public interest and in the interest of justice to produce their opinion in the litigation. CDH then provided SARS with, that's the Cliff Dekker, the law firm, provided SARS with counsel's opinion on the 19th of April 2019 under cover of a letter addressed to SARS, and in which CDH's own views were also recorded. CDH advised that after carefully considering your opinion and the relevant documentation and legislation, CDH can find no reasonable basis upon which to come to a contrary view from counsel. It would appear that CDH had also been requested for its view on the topic, referred to Council for their opinion. CDH concluded that Council's approach is consistent with what was established in the interpretive doctrine. SARS then sent a copy of the opinion to the PP on the 15th of April 2019 and the cover of a letter of even date. And then the letter was attached to the founding affidavit. Go to paragraph 12, simple. The contents of the letter is then cited in the judgment. Yeah. Counsel's legal advice concluded by the following statement. There is no conflict between the PP's subpoena powers and the TM, I think the abbreviation of TM meant the Tax Administration Act, and the TM prohibition on disclosure of SARS, confidential information and taxpayer information. Properly interpreted, the PP's subpoena powers do not include the power to compel disclosure of SARS, confidential information and taxpayer information. This does not undermine the effectiveness of the investigative powers of the PP, because the PP may access such information by making an application to the High Court in terms of Section 69(2)(c) of the PPA or obtaining counsel from the taxpayer. By way of summary, the PP was advised by Maneti SC and Advocate Ferreira that her powers to subpoena did not include the power to compel disclosure of SARS confidential information and taxpayer information. The lesson that the PP should have learned from this advice is that if public power is given to a public body to use for certain purposes, it may not wrongly use it to achieve other purposes. The court then made reference to the Gauteng Gambling Board case and cited a paragraph that it was referring to in that case. So if I go below that, the judgment continues. The powers given to the public protector to subpoena a witness to give evidence or to produce a document may not be invoked to coerce that witness to violate the law under which such a witness operates. Once he was given this advice, the public protector had a choice, either to approach the court in terms of Section 62C of the TAA or to approach the second respondent, being Mr. Zuma, in terms of Section 69(6)(b) of the TAA for his permission to obtain his taxpayer information from SARS. The court then continues to record what happened after the opinion had been rendered and provided to the public protector. And the court continues in paragraph 14 to say that what happened is that on the 24th of April 2019, the public protector responded to the opinion by way of a letter attached to the founding affidavit. In her letter, the PP flatly rejected the independent legal advice of counsel and stated that, whilst I appreciate and know the contents of the legal opinion which accompanied the letter and the reply, I do not agree with the reasons and conclusion contained therein. And without much ado, dismissed the unreasonable conclusion of counsel jointly chosen by her office. These conclusions she referred to are contained in paragraph 12. She persisted with her claim that she was entitled to access taxpayer information in the possession of SARS and stated furthermore that the TAA's exclusion of the PP, among other chapters, the nine institutions, is intended to create a storm in a teacup. That being the case, her letter continued, the PP had already embarked on the process of sourcing a second legal opinion from a different senior counsel. The judgment says that these allegations are not in dispute. And it continues per Mabuse J to say, now all of a sudden she has funds to secure the second senior counsel's opinion. She was mala fide. She failed to uphold the constitution. She was prepared to litigate recklessly. She acted improperly in flagrant disobedience of the constitution and the law. Incidentally, SARS was not invited to participate in the latter briefing process on which the PP already had embarked. It goes without saying that SARS did not take part in the selection of the topic upon which the senior counsel's opinion was sought. SARS was also not informed of the subject on which second counsel's opinion would be sought. The resulting opinion was not shared with SARS, nor was SARS even favored with any update on the public protector's unilateral process to procure advice, diametrically different from the opinion procured jointly by SARS and the public protector. The PP admits these allegations. The PP litigated in bad faith. She attributes her dismal failure to furnish SARS with advocate Sikakane SC's opinion to an oversight emanating from her busy schedule. Despite the fact that this opinion, said opinion is dated 7 May 2019, the public protector only furnished a copy thereof to SARS with her answering affidavit, assuming that she received it immediately after 7 May 2019. The PP sat on the opinion for the rest of May, June, July, August, September, October, and November 2019 without informing SARS about it. The PP was again simply mala fide in failing timeously to share the second senior counsel's opinion with the commissioner. Members will recall that it is already before this committee through the evidence of Mr. Mundu Sithole on the 26th of August. He testified as to the manner in which the second opinion was procured. So I won't repeat that for the purposes of this exercise. Going back to the judgment, Mabuse J continued that the conduct of the PP is inexcusable. To agree to seeking counsel's opinion on a matter, to taking part in the identification of counsel, whose opinion on the matter would be sourced, to preside over the identification of the topic, to reject counsel's opinion, and to seek Advocate Sikakane's SC's opinion without involving SARS is a demonstration of negotiating and acting in bad faith. At the same time, it is indicative of the fact that the PP did not genuinely take part in the process that led to the opinion of Advocate Maneji SC and Advocate Ferreira to obtain objective and erudite opinion. She was not honest. She was opinionated already and only sought the two counsels' opinion to support her opinion. When such opinion did not do so, she rejected it. This is demonstrated by the fact that she readily accepted the opinion expressed by Advocate Sikakane SC. She did not reject the opinion of Advocate Maneji SC and Advocate Ferreira because it was flawed. And she claimed in paragraph 31 of her answering affidavit. But she did so because it did not resonate with her strongly held view, nor did she accept gleefully the opinion of Advocate Sikakane SC because it was correct. She only accepted it because it resonated with her opinion. The public protector had also failed to put a copy of the opinion of Advocate Maneji SC and Advocate Ferreira before Advocate Sikakane SC. Again, in this respect, she acted in bad faith. In rejecting the legal advice of Advocate Maneji SC and Advocate Ferreira, the PP had In paragraph 31 of her answering affidavit, furnished reasons why she did so. She had stated that, on the one hand, I found the Manager SC opinion to be significantly deficient, more perpetually in the glaring failure to take into account the provisions of the Constitution. The Public Protector's letter dated 24 April 2019 concluded by recording the PP's arbitrary predetermination of the issue already prior to receiving any legal opinion potentially supporting her view. At the same time, the letter's conclusion also reflects the PP's resolve that SARS's conduct constituted a breach and a violation of Section 1813 of the Constitution, as well as Section 74 of the PPA. On this basis, the PP's letter repeated her threat that I must therefore reiterate that the consequences of failure to comply with my directives will be pursued as contained in Section 113 of the Public Protector Act. The allegations contained above are not disputed. In the first place, the court continued, as pointed out earlier, the advocate Sikakane SC's opinion was only disclosed to the applicant in the answering affidavit. This is an example of litigating carelessly. For the first time in the answer, the Public Protector was of the view that she found, I have found Maneti SC's opinion to be significantly deficient, more perpetually in its glaring failure to take into account the provisions of the Constitution. The Public Protector attempted to criticize the opinion of Maneti SC. The criticism of the advocate Maneti SC's and advocate Ferreira's opinion is not supported in any way by any analysis whatsoever of the opinion. Although she undertook to conduct a more detailed comparative and critical analysis of the two opinions during legal argument, this was, for inexplicable reasons, not done. Consequently, the Public Protector's case on this crucial point was wholly not pleaded. The precise questions upon which Advocate Sikakane SC's opinion was sought were the following. One, whether the PP can subpoena taxpayer information from SARS. Two, whether the PP is precluded from subpoenaing or obtaining taxpayer information from SARS in terms of the TAA vis-a-vis powers to do so in terms of the PPA. And whether there are any other means available to the PP to obtain the taxpayer information from SARS. In his report, Advocate Sikakane SC stated that, as I have already referred to above, in a case of economic freedom fighters, the Constitutional Court considered whether or not the powers of the Public Protectors can be limited by national legislation. At paragraph 51 of the case, the court held that since our constitution is a supreme law, national legislation cannot have the effect of watering down or effectively nullifying the powers already conferred by the constitution on the PP. It follows, in my view, that the power of compelling the provisions of information to the PP overrides the secrecy provisions of the TM. It is therefore tribal law that the TM cannot have the power of watering down the constitutional powers of the PP to conduct an investigation into any particular state conduct. In conclusion, Advocate Sikakane SC stated that the powers of the Public Protector can only be limited by the Constitution. The Constitution is a superior law to the TM, and the Public Protector may accordingly subpoena taxpayer records from SARS if such is in pursuance of her investigation. This is the view that the Public Protector preferred, the court said. The court then continued to say that the Public Protector is an advocate herself. She clearly had read and understood understood the opinion of Advocate Manity SC and Advocate Ferreira. She let a golden opportunity slip through her fingers, and she could never retrieve it. There's an old adage that says, he who lets an opportunity to pass, he shall never find, for an opportunity once passed is bald behind. In rejecting that opinion, the public protector overlooked the dispositive constitutional judgment that was referred to in that opinion of Advocate Manager SC, and the court then referred to the judgment ex parte speaker of KZN Provincial Legislature in recertification, which was a constitutional judgment, as constitutional court judgment as cited there. The court then referred to a paragraph 24 of that judgment, which had been cited by Advocate Maneji in paragraph 15 of his opinion. Go down, Sepo. And the contents of the paragraph 24 is set out there. The court then continued, Advocate Maneji SC advised that the conclusion reached in paragraph 24 of the case as cited above, as quoted above, accords with the general principles of statutory construction. He advised furthermore that the specific provisions of the TAA take precedence over the general principles of the PPA. The court said it's not the public protector's case that the constitutional court stated the law incorrectly in the said paragraph 24, nor is it her case that the law as set out in the said judgment is not binding on the PP. Furthermore, it's not the PP's case that Advocate Maneji SC and Advocate Ferreira misunderstood the law as set out in that paragraph. And lastly, it is not the PP's case that the judgment in that case has been set aside or is distinguishable. The court then continued to refer to the PP's letter dated 24th April was preceded by a press statement issued on the previous day. The statement related to a different investigation demonstrating the wider effect of the conflicting legal conclusions for which the PP and SARS contended. A copy of the media statement attached to the founding affidavit as Annexure F reflects the public protector's persistence in subpoenaing records in question directly from SARS and applying particularly contempt proceedings. The PP specifically cited in the press statement Section 7, 4, 7, subsection 6, 11, subsection 4 of the PPA. In doing so, she directly quoted potentially the criminative 40,000 criminal penalty and 12 months prison sentence to which the letter provision refers. And then on the 26th of April 2019, SARS responded to the PP, and in its response, it referred to her 23 April 2019 press statement, and the court then proceeded to quote the contents of SARS's response in that paragraph. And it says at the end of paragraph 22, go below, Sepo, that here it is important to point out 22. Yeah, then. It's important to point out that no action was taken further by the PP on the 2018 subpoena. It seems to have died its natural death. In paragraphs 23 and 24, Chair, the court then set out the commissioner's views and the commissioner's submissions. And then from paragraphs 25 until paragraph 39, the court dealt with the respective parties' legal arguments regarding the proper interpretation to give to the phrase just cause in section 11, subsection 3 of the PPA. Go down, Sepa. Go down to paragraph 39. In paragraph 39, yes. So as I said earlier, from paragraphs 25 to 39, the court dealt with the sort of respective parties' arguments about what proper interpretation to give to the phrase just cause, which was in section 11, section 3 of the PPA. And in paragraph 39 of that section of the judgment, the court then gave its own views as to regarding that issue of the phrase of just cause. And the court said in paragraph 39, several factors in this matter are common cause. One of those factors is that commissioner instituted this application in the public interest, and that not only SARS but also the entire tax base stands to benefit from an authoritative pronouncement on this legal dispute between SARS and the public protector. Such pronouncement should bind both SARS and the public protector, and each of them has a direct and substantial interest in such precedent, which would guide them in the lawful exercise of public power without impeding each other's competence. This is the fundamental issue of taxpayer confidentiality, which the commissioner is by law compelled to uphold for the benefit of all taxpayers. This benefit is not limited to the second respondent. If one casts a final look at the path that led to the public protector issuing the subpoena on 21 October 2019, the conclusion is inescapable that the public protector was irrational, unreasonable, acted unlawfully, and had very little regard to the Constitution and the law. It is therefore the duty of this court to hold the scales evenly between the PP and the commissioner, and to declare invalid any practice which, in the absence of the authority of an Act of Parliament, results in one Chapter 9 institution trying to coerce the other Chapter 9 institution to act in contravention of the Constitution and the law. Any legal confrontation between the Chapter 9 institutions must be avoided at all costs as civil means to resolve at all costs and civil means to resolve their disputes, if any, should be fashioned out. So what had happened, Chay, is that the PP in her answering affidavit had sought to incorporate a conditional counter application to be granted taxpayer information on the strength of the court order as contemplated by the applicable legislation. The court dealt with the PP's attempt to, with this counter application in from paragraphs 40 to 46 of its judgment. I've partly read paragraph 40. The court continued, the counter application was brought about because of what was perceived to be the concerns of the taxpayer. The taxpayer is the second respondent, Mr. Zuma. It was again stated in the answering affidavit that the conduct of the commissioner in refusing or failing to furnish the public protector with the information or documents required in the impugned subpoena falls foul of section 11(3) of the PPA, as it is not excusable on the basis of the just cause defense qualification. With regard to the counter application, The Commissioner contends that it is formally and substantially defective in as much as it does not satisfy the requirements of Rule 6.7 or Rule 6.11 of the Uniform Rule of Court. The argument raised by the Commissioner against the said counter-application is that it does not have any notice of motion for the paragraph 42, suppose. And this is what the court found in relation to the PP's counter-application. Firstly, considering that the Commissioner was not the only party in the circumstances, it was fatal for the Public Protector to fail to bring a counter-application without a proper notice of motion. It is not known whether a copy of the counter-application was served on the fourth respondent. The possibility exists that if the relief sought in the counter-application was specifically spelled out in the notice of motion, fourth respondent might have had a different approach to the counter-application. As no notice in respect of the relief sought in the counter-application was served on the fourth respondent, or as there is no allegation in the papers before the court that the counter-application was served on the fourth respondent, granting the relief so sought would have meant granting the relief that directly and adversely affected the fourth respondent's rights. Such a relief cannot be implemented without prejudice to the fourth respondent. The Public Protector has also been warned by the Constitutional Court in paragraph 155 of the Public Protector versus South African, Reserve Bank judgment, Supra, that she is under a higher duty to respect the law, to fulfill procedural requirements, and to treat respectfully when dealing with rights. Paragraph 53, the court continued, no case has been made out by the Public Protector for the relief that he seeks in the answering affidavit. The Public Protector relies entirely on tweets supposedly sent by the second respondent as a basis for seeking the relief that she sets out in the counter application. The court then set out the statement and said that it's clear from what the court had just said in the previous sentence is clear from that statement. And below that, the court continues, this is all that the PP relied on for her counter application. Unsubstantiated tweets. There was no proof of the authenticity of the tweets. She regarded them as the taxpayer's written consent in terms of section 69(6)(b) of the TAA. She was wrong, for they are not, without much ado, admissible as evidence. In the absence of admissible evidence that the tweets originated from the second respondent, which in my view was the cornerstone of the counter application has not been substantiated and is doomed to failure. Even if the court were to decide the counter application in the favor of the PP, and assume that it was a proper application in terms of section 69(2)(c) of the TAA, the court would still have a good reason to refuse to grant the order sought for the count application. Firstly, section 69(6)(a) of the TM provides that the court may not grant the order unless satisfied that the following circumstances apply. A, the information cannot be obtained somewhere. There's no obligation by the PP anywhere in her papers that she was unable to obtain the information elsewhere. It was pointed out to Mr. Mbofu that if the Public Protector seriously wanted the second respondent's taxpayer information, she could have approached the taxpayer's bookkeeper or auditors with the taxpayer's consent. The taxpayer's information in the possession of the Commissioner is not only always on information that was obtained from the taxpayer. Some of it might have come from other sources. Therefore, the commissioner was not at large to disclose such information. In this regard, the commissioner's case enjoys the unqualified support of the well-established law in the case that the court referred to in that paragraph and cited a relevant portion of the case. That's the case of Wealth and another versus Hall, which I'm not going to read, Chair. To conclude this section of the judgment, the court continued and states and held that the public protector did not explain why she did not obtain the second respondent's consent in order to access his taxpayers' information, either from his auditors or taxpayers, or in terms of Section 669, Subsection 2, Subsection C. She had an opportunity to do so. She failed to do so. She was advised to apply to court for the proper order. She still fails to do so. In conclusion, this court finds that the public protector has not made out a good case for the counterclaim. The counterclaim can therefore not succeed. In the next section of the judgment, Chair, the judge makes reference to something that he had alluded to earlier in the judgment, which was an attempt to hand in an affidavit made by Mr. Zuma, who is cited as the second respondent. The affidavit was styled as the second respondent's explanatory affidavit. The court dealt with this briefly in the judgment in paragraphs 47 and 48. The court rejected Mr. Zuma's explanatory affidavit for the three reasons that it gave in paragraph 48. Tipo, can you go to paragraph 48, please? The second sentence. The court said, for three reasons, the affidavit has to be rejected. Firstly, it was not properly before the court. Secondly, it was filed late. And thirdly, and lastly, no purpose in the eyes of Advocate Mbofu SC and of the court would have been served by allowing it into evidence. This affidavit is therefore inadmissible. The court then went on to deal with the issue of costs from paragraph 49 of the judgment onwards. I'll start reading from paragraph 50, because Shirley. Paragraph 50, the court said, the starting point, in my view, with regards to the order of costs, is paragraph 155 of the judgment of the public protector versus the South African Reserve Bank, which states that the public protector falls into the category of a public litigant. A high duty as the Constitution's principal agent to respect the law, to fulfill procedural requirements, and to tread respectfully when dealing with rights. The public protector, the court said, is a public litigant. It is expected of her to always act with a high degree of perfection, that she will at all times act with care and respect for the Constitution and the law, that she should never show any gross disregard for her professional responsibilities or act inappropriately and in an egregious manner. She should never act malafide or in bad faith, or exhibit any gross negligence in her conduct. The PP is therefore enjoined by the Constitution to observe the highest standard of conduct in litigation. Under certain circumstances, public officials like the PP who acts in a representative capacity may be ordered to pay the costs out of their own pockets. Some of such circumstances are where the PEP exhibits gross disregard for her personal responsibilities, where she acts inappropriately and in an egregious manner, or if she is guilty of bad faith or gross negligence in conducting litigation. The court then referred to the judgment of Sash Trust versus Minister of Social Development, as well as later on in that paragraph, the judgment of Gauteng Gambling Board versus MEC for Economic Development in Gauteng, which is an SCA judgment. Further down the paragraph, Sipple. Yeah, go. Yeah. Counsel for the commissioner submits that the public protector should be ordered to pay 15% of the costs de bonis propriis. He mentioned 8 reasons in support of his submission. Some of those reasons are as follows. 1, the public protector sought the second senior counsel's opinion on a different topic. In this way, she acted with bad faith. 2, she failed to put a copy of the legal opinion of senior and junior counsel before the second senior counsel. Again, this is an instance where the public protector acted mala fide. She was advised to obtain a court order in order to gain access to the taxpayer's information. This advice was based on the provisions of the TAA. She failed to take advice and in the process acted with gross disregard for her professional responsibilities. She sought advice from senior counsel without involving the commissioner. She litigated in bad faith. She insisted that the commissioner should comply with the subpoena despite being advised that it would be unlawful in terms of the TAA for the commissioner to do so. In this manner, she litigated recklessly, failed to uphold the Constitution and the law. She was, in my view, improperly and in flagrant disobedience of the constitutional norms. She abused her powers. She used her powers to subpoena for wrong reasons. She had been advised to seek clarity from the court about the extent of her powers vis-a-vis the provisions of the TAA, but she failed to do so, again, unprofessionally in the circumstances. For no valid reasons at all, she insisted that she was entitled to the information she had asked the commissioner to furnish her with. She thereby overlooked advices, failed to observe national legislation, and had this wrong impression that she had unlimited power. She failed in this regard to uphold the Constitution. She failed to seek a proper written confirmation of the second respondent to access his taxpayer information. This arose obviously from her failure to study the TAA, to follow the advice, and from the fact that she wrongly thought that her powers in terms of Section 7(4)(a) of the PPA could trump the provisions of the TAA. She also failed to acquaint herself with the provisions of the TAA, whereas an advocate she should and could have done so. She failed dismally, short of the high standard expected of an advocate. The court then in paragraph 52 said, on the other hand, it was argued by Advocate Mbofu SC that because the issue involved in this matter turned on legal issues, PP should not be made to pay the 15% of the cost stay bonus pro rata. I have stated above the circumstances under which the PP may be ordered to pay the cost stay bonus pro rata. Accordingly, nature of issues involved is not material. What is of paramount importance at this stage is whether such circumstances that support an order of cost stay bonus pro rata against the PP do exist. In my view, they do exist, and no valid reason has been furnished why this court may make such an order. In conclusion, the High Court said this court is satisfied that the Commissioner has made out a good case for the relief that he seeks, and that the counter application on the other end lacks merit. So the court then made an order granting the following order is accordingly made. One, it's declared that a South African Revenue Service official is permitted and is required under the provision of just cause contained in Section 11.3 of the PPA, read with Section 61.1 of the TAA, to withhold taxpayer information as defined in Section 67.1A of the TAA. Two, it's furthermore hereby declared that the PP's subpoena powers do not extend to the taxpayer information. Three, the first respondent's counterclaim is hereby dismissed with costs. The first respondent is hereby ordered to pay the costs of this application. And the first respondent is hereby ordered to pay de bonis proprius 15% of the applicant's tax costs. Chair, I want to turn now to the PP's appeal directly to the Constitutional Court, but subject to what the Chair has to say, perhaps this is a good time to take the tea break, but I can continue, Chair.
Okay. We'll take an early tea break. It's a few minutes away. We'll take a tea break for 15 minutes. Thank you. We'll pause.
Recording stopped.
And I think I may have mentioned earlier as well that in April 2020, the PP then made an application for leave to appeal directly to the Constitutional Court in terms of the rules of that court. And she sought leave to appeal against both, against the High Court's judgment, both on the merits as well as against the personal costs order that was given against her. So for the judgment is in bundle C, folder 3, item 17. And as I said previously, Chair, the judgment itself was handed down on the 15th of December 2020 and was a unanimous judgment of the Constitutional Court that was written by Justice Madlanga. So we can see the order that was made, page 594. Is it slow? Mm-hmm. Show the whole order. Yeah. So the order that the Constitutional Court made was when leave to appeal against the declarator by the High Court that a South African Revenue Service official is entitled to withhold taxpayer information in terms of Section 11.3 of the PPA, read with Section 69.1 of the TAA, is refused. So the court refused leave to appeal the merits, which is the declarer's order that was granted in favor of the Commissioner, to leave to appeal against the High Court's dismissal of the PP's counter application is refused. 3, leave to appeal against the High Court order that the public protector must pay the bonus proprius 15% of the tax cost of the commissioner for SARS is granted. The appeal is upheld, and the High Court order referred to in paragraph 3 is set aside. So in other words, the personal cost order against the PP was set aside by the Constitutional Court, and it then ordered that each party was to pay his or her own costs in that application in that court. So the Constitutional Court then dealt with the merits of the PP's application, that is the issue of the PP's power to subpoena taxpayer information from paragraph 14 onwards of the judgment. From paragraph 14 to paragraph 27, in those paragraphs, the Constitutional Court set out the PP's legal submissions regarding the merits question, as well as the Constitutional Court's response to those submissions. Go to paragraph 17. So in paragraph 17, the Justice Madlanga wrote, the public protector's argument for a direct appeal rests firstly on urgency. The alleged urgency is grounded in the need to finalize the investigation with expedition. The public protector contends that an appeal to the full court of the High Court or the Supreme Court of Appeal before approaching this court will take years. She contends that without reference to the possibility of seeking leave to appeal, she contends thus, without reference to the possibility of seeking leave to appeal to the full court or Supreme Court of Appeal by way of urgency. If acting expeditiously was any consideration, the public protector would not have gone on a power testing expedition, which could potentially be and actually turned out to be protracted. She could have done the simple thing of obtaining the taxpayer's written consent in terms of section 69(6)(b) of the TAA. In its judgment, the High Court deals with the admissibility of an affidavit that former President Zuma sought to file late and out of turn in that court. That court refused to accept the affidavit. Of importance for our purposes is that, even though we did not have sight was to seek a High Court order in terms of section 69(2)(c). Like the option of seeking the taxpayer's written consent, this too would have been more direct. If the public protector's reasons for needing the information were cogent enough, this alternative would have been better suited to delivering the desired result. And it cannot possibly lie in the mouth of the public, lie in the public protector's mouth that she did not believe in the cogency of the reasons for which she needed the taxpayer information. An approach to the High Court is a legal vehicle that exists, whereas testing whether courts will agree with the mooted power, will agree that the mooted power does exist, is unknown, uncertain terrain. So the urgency argument is contrived, and as it is the most important point for the direct appeal, that detracts significantly from the public protector's entitlement to a direct appeal. So from paragraph 19 to paragraph 23, the the Constitutional Court then considered the question of the PP's prospects of success in an appeal, were she to be granted leave to appeal to that court. So this is a necessary element to be determined in an application of this kind, an application for leave to appeal. So the question was asked by the court in paragraph 19. The public protector further contends that she has strong prospects of success. Does she? The court then, in the paragraph that followed, captured the public protector's legal submissions in favor of her good prospects. What she said were her good prospects of success on appeal. Go down, Tipo. And from paragraph 24 onwards, the court then gave its judgment on the merits issue, which is a factor in whether or not she has a good prospect of success on appeal. Justice Mazlanga said the following: let me first make it clear that I will not grapple with the submission that there is some constitutional hierarchy within Chapter 9 institutions. That is not necessary for present purposes. Section 69(1) of the TAA provides that SARS officials must preserve the secrecy of taxpayer information and may not disclose taxpayer information to a person who is not a SARS official. Thereafter, the Act creates narrow exceptions to this prohibition. The disclosure of taxpayer information in compliance with a subpoena issued by the PP is not one of the exceptions. SARS officials are thus enjoined to withhold taxpayer information even in the face of such subpoena. Any other interpretation is at odds with the clear wording of Section 69(1). The interpretation advocated by the PP is not viable. If that be so, we are left with the question whether the PP is entitled as of right to taxpayer information based on her remaining interpretation of the Constitution. That question arises from the first three arguments, which I next deal with. The effect of the public protector's argument is that in the face of the constitutional power she is asserting, Section 69(1) is constitutionally invalid. I use effect because she does not argue that the section is invalid. According to her, she is entitled as of right to taxpayer information upon the issue of a subpoena. Her case is fundamentally flawed. Section 69(1) can only not have its force, which is to deny the public protector access to taxpayer information if it is invalid. But according to MEC for Development Planning and Local Government Gauteng, she is not entitled to any relief that effectively flows from the unconstitutionality of an act which has not been declared by a court. The court then cited what Yakub J held in that case. In paragraph 26, Justice Mazlanga wrote, even though the public protector does not expressly argue that Section 69(1) is constitutionally invalid, the effect is the same. Thus, the authority I have just referred to stands in her way. She cannot wish Section 69(1) away. She should have brought a direct frontal challenge to the constitutionality of the section for including her office within its sweep, or to the TAA for failing to include the office in the exceptions it creates. The PP's reliance on EFF versus Speaker is misplaced. That case never suggested that there should not be a constitutional challenge where one is necessary. The course of proceeding from unconstitutionality that has not been declared, proposed by the PP, appears to be incompatible with Section 172(1) of the Constitution, which obliges a court to declare a statutory provision which is inconsistent with the Constitution invalid to the extent of the inconsistency. This course could also give rise to uncertainty about the status of Section 69(1). As a result, absent a direct frontal challenge to the validity of Section 69(1), there are no reasonable prospects of success. In the circumstances, other reasons for seeking leave to appeal directly to this court, like a saving in costs and time, the absence of disputes of fact, then the inevitability of the matter reaching this court and the fact that this court is well placed to consider the application pale into insignificance. Leave to appeal directly to this court falls to be refused. Justice Madlanga then turned to deal with the issue of the personal costs order made by the High Court against the PP. Chair, you will recall that when I was dealing with the High Court judgment, I mentioned some 9 reasons which formed the basis upon which that court granted the personal cost order that it did against the PP.
The report says something else.
Justice Madlanga then turned to this issue from paragraph 34 of his judgment. Where he said, I must now decide whether the High Court exercised its discretion judicially in ordering the PP to pay 15% of the commissioner's costs. Their bonus trophies. What led to this order were the following. In issuing the subpoena, the PP acted in fraudem legis, literally in fraud of the law. In first saying she had no funds for the first opinion, but later seeking and paying for a second opinion, the PP's conduct was mala fide. Other facts that evinced mala fides were the PP's failure to invite the commissioner to participate in briefing advocate Sikakane SC and not sharing the opinion obtained from him with the commissioner. Public protector was adjudged to have acted unreasonably, arbitrarily, and in bad faith because she had a proclivity to operate outside of the law and a deep-rooted recalcitrance to accept advice from senior and junior counsel, and it was expected of the public protector to act with a high degree of perfection. Here, Justice Madlanga is merely summarizing the reasons given by the High Court for the cost order that it did. He then says, I deal with these in turn, and he starts to do so from paragraph 35 onwards. Firstly, he started with the issue, the finding by the High Court that the subpoena was issued in fraud of the law. Justice Madlanga wrote that the public protector's view that she was entitled to issue the subpoena regardless of the prohibition in Section 69(1) is misguided. But it appears to have been a genuinely held view. Based on that genuinely held view, there is no cogent basis for suggesting that the subpoena was issued for a purpose other than the investigation the public protector was conducting. The High Court's conclusion that it was issued in fraudem legis is without factual foundation and constitutes a misdirection on the facts. Going to the High Court's finding that the PP was mala fides relating to the issue of lack of funds, the Constitutional Court found that the public protector explains that the first opinion was sought and obtained in one financial year, and the second opinion was sought and obtained in the ensuing financial year. She did not have funds in the first financial year, and she had them in the following financial year. That sounds like a perfectly sensible explanation. The High Court's conclusion of that faith is thus a leap in logic and yet another misdirection. dealing with the next reason for the cost order, which is that the PP was malafides in not inviting the commissioner to participate in the second opinion and in not sharing their opinion, the Constitutional Court said an incontrovertible or even common cause fact is that the PP did advise the commissioner beforehand that she would seek a second opinion. She was not cagey about it. She was not required to involve the commissioner in seeking that second opinion. And she was entitled to obtain it if she was not satisfied with the first opinion. In those circumstances, failure to share the second opinion hardly justifies a conclusion of malafides. Had she been acting malafide in this regard, she would not even have shared with the commissioner the fact that she was going to seek a second opinion. Also, as the commissioner was aware that the PP was to seek a second opinion, he could have asked for it. Or at the very least, he could have asked if the PP eventually got the second opinion she was to seek. Nothing suggests that she might have withheld it, not when she had volunteered information that she was to seek it. The next issue that Justice Madlanga dealt with is the High Court's finding that the PP had a proclivity to operate outside of the law and a deep-rooted recalcitrance to accept advice from counsel. And Justice Madlanga said, according to the High Court, a proclivity to operate outside of the law and a deep-rooted recalcitrance to accept advice from senior and junior counsel were proof of unreasonable, arbitrary, and malafide conduct. A dictionary meaning of proclivity is a tendency to do something regularly, an inclination. An inclination or predisposition towards something. What we have on the facts of this case is only the one instance of not being happy with the first opinion and, as a result, seeking a second opinion. How that becomes a proclivity escapes me. As they say, one swallow does not make a summer, does not a summer make. Also mind-boggling is the holding that the PP acted outside the law in seeking a second opinion, when she was perfectly entitled to seek it. In fact, in addition to being entitled to seek the second opinion, the PP acted on the basis of it. Strangely, the High Court regards the opinion of one senior counsel as gospel and that of the other not. The reality is that the PP had two conflicting opinions and she preferred one. The correct legal position could have been what was stated in the one or the other, or in neither. The conclusion that by picking the one opinion, she acted unreasonably, arbitrarily, and in bad faith, thus beggars belief and is gratuitous. In fact, it was wrong of the High Court to assume that the public protector was obliged to take the advice of senior counsel and to conclude that failure to take it is per se reckless or malafide. The court then went on to deal with the next basis for the personal cost order against the PP, which was the expectation that the PP must act with a high degree of perfection. And here, Justice Madlanga said, as stated before, the High Court held that it was expected of the public protector to always act with a high degree of perfection. It is one thing to expect the highest possible standard of performance from a public official within whatever set parameters of the workplace. But it is quite another to hold that the slightest deviation from that standard must result in a personal costs order in the event that the deviation leads to litigation. If the latter were true, all litigation in which public officials came off second best would result in personal cost orders against them, And that would be because the slightest deviation does not meet the standard of perfection. This has never been our law. It is not any deviation. It is not any deviation from the set norm that results in, it is not any deviation from the set norm that results in personal cost orders. To attract such order, the deviation must be reprehensible or egregious. It must constitute a gross disregard for professional responsibility. This is a far cry from ordering costs de bonis propriis as a result of a dip, even by a slight margin from perfection. If the conduct of a public official has fallen short of the required standard and given rise to litigation, it may attract a cost order against her or him in his or her official capacity. It is only where there is reprehensibility in whatever form that the punitive step of ordering costs de bonis propriis may then be taken. So the High Court's standard of a high degree of perfection was yet a misdirection. So Chair, the Constitutional Court then went on to make some general remarks from paragraph 41 to 46. In essence, in these general remarks, Justice Madlanga was sounding a caution against what he described as a developing trend of seeking personal cost orders in all, if not most, matters involving the PP. This he stated in paragraph, from paragraph 42 onwards up until in the Busasa matter, former Chief Justice Mokgweng Mokgweng, when he commented about what he described as the magnification of the PP's errors, the former Chief Justice cited these general remarks made by Justice Madlanga, in particular in paragraphs 42, 43 and 45 of this judgment. The Constitutional Court then, Chair, made the order that I showed before. So it also appears in paragraph 610, sorry, page 610. In essence, okay, go down. Wait, there's order. Yeah. And the essence of that order was to, the effect of it in essence was to not grant the PP leave to appeal to the Constitutional Court in relation to the merits, which is the PP's entitlement to taxpayer information. And I've already read to the committee what the court found in that regard. In other words, it upheld the High Court. And the court then set aside the personal costs order that was made against the PP, and for the reasons that I read to the committee as to what Justice Madlanga said about the High Court's finding in that regard. The PP's leave to appeal the High Court's finding on the counter application was also refused. Yeah, in relation to that application, that was before the High Court, each party was to pay their own costs. So after this judgment, which was handed down in December 2020, the PP then returned to the High Court and sought leave to appeal to that court against the declaratory order that the court had granted. Um, members will recall that I've just mentioned now that the PP was unsuccessful in the Constitutional Court on that aspect. She succeeded on the personal costs aspect, but not on this aspect. So the PP then returned to the High Court and made an application for leave to appeal. She also applied for condemnation from the High Court for the lateness of her application for leave to appeal to the High Court. The delay was caused by the fact that she first started with the direct appeal to the Constitutional Court, with the result that when she returned to the High Court with her application for leave to appeal, she was outside of the time frames and she had to ask for condemnation from the High Court for the lateness of that application. The matter came before Mawuze J once again, and in his judgment, which is also in bundle C, folder 3, is it item 11, I think? We don't have to go there, Tsepo. Both the PP's applications for condemnation and for leave to appeal were refused by Mabuse J with costs, including the costs of two counsel. So that brings to an end the exercise of just placing in detail the judgments that I have just done for the purpose of contextualizing then some of the aspects of the judgment of the minority judgment of the former Chief Justice Mogoeng, upon which reliance has been made and which have been referred to in these proceedings thus far. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Over to you, Mr. Bauer.
The committee will recall that last week I dealt with a number of aspects in relation to the judgment dealing with the Gordhan SARS unit matter. And there are a couple of those aspects that I haven't dealt with. Some of them, there's an overlap with evidence that's being led. And as this exercise, we do not want to delve into the evidence specifically before the committee. It wouldn't necessarily be conducive to deal with those aspects without actually looking at the evidence. But there are some aspects of that two issues that I do think we could take the committee through, which does not have this overlap in evidence. And these are the factors that the High Court took into account when it considered that there was bias on the part of the public protector. And the one aspect that I do want to deal with is the statements regarding Her Ladyship Justice Patrol. The one aspect, and the other one is the issue of recruitment, which we'll come to. Now, there was a twofold approach in the judgment about statements being made. And so before I go to the question of the statements regarding Her Ladyship Justice Patrol, I must also deal with the statements which Minister Pravin Gordhan had made against the public protector, because they both sort of they both appear from the judgment. And in the answering affidavit, you will also recall there was a part A and a part B in the matter. And in the answering affidavit opposing the part A relief sought by the Minister Gordhan in the matter, the public protector took issue with the allegations made by him in his founding affidavit in relation to her. She then brought a strikeout application, which one sees at Shepherd Bundle E, item 7. And you go to the PDF page 385.
I can put the folder.
Yeah, so go into the folder. Five. And then you go to PDF 385. Yeah. The committee will recall that in the judgment of Chief Justice, then Chief Justice Mogoeng, this fell under I think he called the comments that had been made, do unto others as you want done unto you. I think that was a part of the minority judgment that you were taken to. Okay, so you must go and just click on TDF 385. No, just go to the PDF. Click where you see 40 and you make it 385.
Yeah.
Right. So if you go up, sorry, just go up, Shippo. Right. You will see that is the notice that was under Rule 650, which is the notice to strike out certain paragraphs. And if you go down, you see the various paragraphs of Minister Gordhan's founding affidavit on the basis that they were scandalous, vexatious, threatening, irrelevant, speculative, opinionated, argumentative, and or inappropriate. I think I've summarized the argument. Go down. Right, and then there's an affidavit just after that, which is filed by the public protector, which doesn't go into much detail as to why the allegations fall into the different categories. But usually this would be argued in court, so I don't make much of this. But what you will find is that... So go back up. Sorry, Shippo, I'm leading you a garden path. Go back up to the application to strike out. If one groups them together, then paragraphs 12 to 22 relates to general allegations that the public protector was part of fake news about the SARS unit, state capture, and reasons that I'm opposed to directive to restore good governance. For example, that she had permitted the office and its extensive powers to be weaponized in this political war against unity and renewal. That's just sort of the gist. Paragraph 41 described reports that had been overturned in court. Paragraphs 43 and 46.3 alleged that the public protector had shown a consistent pattern of disregard for her constitutional mandate and what was described in the affidavit as stunning incompetence, irrationality, and negligence. Also alleges that the public protector is attempting to remove Minister Gordhan from office to achieve political objectives. Paragraph 80, paragraph 100 and 128 alleges that the public protector ignored the Kroon apology and cast an appalling slur on Mr. Pillay as being unqualified. Paragraphs 228 and 32-33. So it was only those two paragraphs, all right, which it then seeks to put out, and dealt with improper motives. Now, I want to specifically go to 228 and 233 in the judgment. Before we do so, the last one is paragraph 234, the taxpayer of South Africa should have to continue to fund unlawful conduct, was the statement that's being made. Now, if we go to the founding affidavit, go to bundle 4. Yeah. You went to 5, and I just go to 4. 7, 4.
Okay.
Yeah. It's paragraph 228. In the index, go into the affidavit. you have to go to, hold on. Click on the, go to 130. PDF 210. So, Minister Gordhan states, finally, whilst I have great respect for the Office of the Public Protector, I doubt the competence, integrity, legal literacy and constitutional grasp of its incumbent of the powers, duties and functions. Whilst it is unfortunate that the sentiment must be expressed, I maintain that the suspension and interdict will be in the overall interest of justice because I strongly doubt the bona fides of the Public Protector. In investigating and issuing this report, the Public Protector has confirmed that I'm the subject of 3 ongoing investigations by our office. I'm not aware of anyone who has been singled out and pursued by our office in this way. And then he sets out certain items, but as I pointed out that it was 228 and 233, that was so to be struck out, and he says in 233, on the basis of the above considerations, I'm entitled to have these issues adjudicated upon by a court of law in the pending judicial review before being compelled to endure the prejudicial and punitive processes required for the remedial action. All right. The Public Protector deals with these allegations at bundle in item 4. Volume 12, just go to PDF 1304. Right? And she deals with it in paragraph 11. And she essentially sets out what her complaint is in respect of each of the items. So if you just scroll down, finding that it was fake news, that the narrative of the rogue unit in paragraph 80, the focus of the investigation appears to join this pattern, and she sets out and she explains essentially, just go down, I summarized it early on, so I just want to take the committee through the gist of it, yeah, right? And essentially, she got done in this regard. And she, in addition to that, sought a declaratory order in a counter application. And one sees this from paragraph 70 of the judgment. Essentially, it is an application for a declarative order that Minister Gordhan failed to comply with his constitutional duty to assist and protect the Public Protector, and she seeks a punitive cost order against him. Now, if you go to bundle C, item 3, you go open the judgment, 18. It's 17. So you go to page, yeah, go to page 17. So in respect of the counter application, the court describes the judgment, the order in paragraph 70 that is being sought, and that's the counter application, and it goes down. A failure on the part of him to have complied his constitutional duty, go further down. Public Protector alleges that Minister Gordhan violated his constitutional duties by hurling insults and litigation threats and submits that the language used by the minister, Prime Minister Gordhan, in his founding affidavit was contemptuous and unjustified. She contends that he therefore made himself guilty of contempt. She further alleges Mr. Gordhan adopted an obstructionist strategy during the investigation and in so doing breached his duties in terms of Section 181(1) of the Constitution and Section 6 sub 9 of the Public Protector Act by refusing to allow the Public Protector the requisite information to determine whether special circumstances existed. And the court says that the declaratory order is an order by which a dispute over the existence of some legal right or obligation is resolved, either an existing, prospective, or contingent, and no specific consequential relief need to be claimed. And it then sets out what is a trite proposition that a court has a discretion whether to grant or refuse an application for a declaratory order, and that it would not grant a declaratory order where the legal position has already been clearly laid down by statute. It says that Mr. Gordhan does not dispute that it is a constitutional duty under Section 181(3) of the Constitution to assist and protect the independence, impartiality, dignity and effectiveness of the Public Protector in the performance of our obligations. The granting of a declaratory as sought by the Public Protector in paragraph 1 of the notice of motion would therefore serve no purpose. Paragraph 2 of the notice of motion, the Public Protector seeks an order that Mr. Gordhan had failed to comply with his constitutional duty to assist and protect the Public Protector as required by 183 of the Constitution during her investigation of the complaint against him. The court then found, firstly, there is no doubt that Mr. Gordhan complied with his constitutional duties. He has complied with the investigation by the Public Protector by submitting two evidence affidavits when directed to, supported by documents. Secondly, Minister Gordhan is entitled to disagree with the report and exercise his rights to challenge it in these proceedings. By challenging the report, he is not in contravention of any constitutional obligation. Based on the information available, there is no evidence to support the granting of the relief claimed by the Public Protector. As far as the contempt allegations are concerned, and then they set out the provision of the Act that deals with contempt. And then it says the rules or the rules relating to investigations by the Public Protector and matters incidental provides as follows. If the Public Protector is satisfied that the person has acted in a manner that constitutes contempt of the Public Protector, then envisaged in Section 9, he or she may report the matter to the South African Police Service or apply to the High Court by notice of motion supported by an affidavit in terms of the rules. So for an order that the person be declared in contempt of court, the public or the Public Protector, and that the court deals with him or her in terms of Section 9(1)(b) of the Act, in any manner in which could have dealt with him or her if she had committed contempt in relation to the court. The condition is that the person has insulted the Public Protector or the Deputy Public Protector, has done an act in connection with an investigation which, if the said investigation had been proceedings in the court of law, would have constituted contempt of court. And then it sets out the procedure for the notice for lodging such an application in sub 3. Gordhan. Right, and it tells you what has got to be in that notice. And then, as alluded in the striking out application above, the majority of the allegations complained about in the founding affidavit of Minister Gordhan directed at one of the grounds review, namely that the Public Protector acted with an improper motive and that she was biased. But although it was irrelevant for the purposes of this application, Minister Gordhan also thought it necessary to express his personal views about Advocate Mkhubane's competence, integrity, legal literacy, and constitutional grasp of the Public Protector's powers, duties, and functions. As stated in the striking out application, these statements are irrelevant and scandalous and are struck from the founding affidavit. There are, however, no contempt proceedings that have been launched against Minister Gordhan as contemplated in Rule 26. And no relief has been sought against Minister Gordhan in the notice of motion to find him guilty of contempt. We are therefore not at liberty to deal with the allegations of contempt, and the counter application is therefore dismissed. The full bench upheld the public protector's application to strike out only paragraphs 2-8 and 232 of Minister Goodan's founding affidavit and found costs in favour of a go-to. Right, and the court ordered as follows in respect of that. Go to page 725. And we see that in the order. There is a reason in, no, go up. Page 725, go down. Right. So the application to strike out is very specific. It's granted in respect of paragraphs 228 and 232 of Minister Goodan's founding affidavit with costs. The court did not strike out the other paragraphs which one saw, and I showed you from the application to strike out to do that. What transpires after that is that there is an application for leave to appeal against the High Court's ruling in respect of the paragraphs that were not struck out, and that persists as part of the application for leave to appeal to the higher courts. Right. You'll also see that the counter application is dismissed. Now, on the other side of it is the public protector had made statements regarding Alicia Potterill J in her affidavit in part B before the full bench of the High Court, which they had found to be objectionable, and made comments in the judgment or as one will see evident from the judgment. Now, the relevant parts of the public protector's affidavit in that regard, one sees in folder number 7, item 6. Let me just go there. Yeah. Right, and then you go to page 1013 of the PDF. Yeah. Right, and it's paragraph 95. Go up, actually go up to 94. Let's put it into context. Mr. Goodan's own evidence shined a okay, that deals with that. Go down to 95. The High Court further committed a gross misinterpretation of the applicable, the Executive Ethics Code, Section 2.3 expressly states that members may not deliberately or inadvertently mislead the President or the Premier, or as the case may be, the legislature. Inexplicably, the High Court chose to rewrite the said provisions of the Code and adopted Mr. Goodan's view that the Code only prohibits willfully misleading the legislature to which they are accountable. High Court did so by deliberately omitting the words inadvertently mislead from the actual code. The High Court states in paragraph 22 of the judgment that the review ground set up by Mr. Goodan is that he did not willfully mislead the National Assembly. I found that Mr. Goodan dishonestly concealed the fact that at the Ambani meeting there was a Gupta present. As if to highlight its gross misplaced interpretation of the code, the court went on to state on paragraphs 23 and 24 the following. The EFF submitted that it matters not that the Goodan may not willfully have misled the legislature. An innocent mistake is sufficient. This is, of course, contrary to the wording of paragraph 2.3a of the code, specifying that it must be done willfully. And then if you look at, so that was the one statement, and if you go to PDF 1047, which is paragraph 179. Okay. All right. You will see that Patrol J overlooked the legal doctrine applicable to the rogue unit matter. That is, when a party has concealed his misconduct, the limitations period does not begin to run until after the duped party discovers or due diligence should have discovered his claim against the deceitful party. A good illustration in government matters, you've got the wrong paragraph, just go up. 177. One up again. They go down again. Ah, now these are... Right. Contrary to Patel Joy's in erroneous interpretation, the statute does set forth in strict prescription period. Rather, the public protector is given unbridled discretion to permit in special circumstances a complaint not reported within the 2-year period of the occurrence of the incidents. Patrol J blithely overlooks the apsedarian proposition that the public protector's investigations are triggered for the most part by complaints filed by citizens, the majority of whom are lay persons. Patrol J ignores that the time between a citizen's acquisition of knowledge of maladministration sufficient to justify a complaint to the public protector and the actual occurrence of the incidents will never perfectly fit the 2-year time limit. She boldly and falsely asserts that the complaints relating to Gordhan follows from a meeting in 2010 and the establishment of an investigative unit in 2007. She concludes that the public protector was not entitled to entertain these complaints. Not so. It is perfectly within the instincture of her discretion to accept these matters for investigation, and she needs only articulate special circumstances to do so. Right? It then says, by Gordhan's own admission, the establishment of the investigation unit was secretive, or at least not a matter of public knowledge. It carried out spying functions for a considerable period of time after it was created, and the equipment it purchased for such purposes are still not accounted for. The continuing violation doctrine overrides the statute of limitation relied on by Mr. Gordhan and supported by Patrol J. And so it says it is alleged that the implicated persons ran a covert unit within SARS, unlawfully revealed taxpayer information, were engaged in unlawful interception and other wrongs from the interception of the rogue unit until at least 2014. It is simply ridiculous for a Mr. Gordhan, as was upheld by Patrol J, to assume that ordinary citizens would have sniffed out these covert activities or uncovered sufficient facts within 2 years from 2007. And then it goes on. Now, there are other statements made by the public protector about Patrol J, and the judgment that are couched in what one would regard as generally accepted phrases, that she erred in a judgment or she misstated herself, etc. And the full bench doesn't take criticism with these comments, but in each judgment, if you go to the judgment, go to bundle E7, item 4 on page 14. It's a different reference to the judgment, but just go to item 4, page 14. Yeah. Right. Now that's the start of it. Sorry, Shepa. Rather go to the judgment we used to use in at bundle C number 18. PDF, paragraphs 58 to 61. 639. I want that is 58 to 59 of the judgment, but that's not the UI. Go up to paragraphs 58 to 61 of the judgment. No, it is. Go up, not down, up. You're going down. Paragraph 68. No, you, 58, sorry. 58 to 61. Yeah, so 636. Okay. And this deals with the Executive Ethics Code. And then the report says what compounds the public protector's misdirection. And that's a misdirection in having used the executive ethics, the wrong Executive Ethics Code, is that she then makes complete about turn by departing from a report and now argues that an inadvertent or mistaken misrepresentation violates the Executive Ethics Code. In doing so, she then shifts the focus to the judgment of Potterl J, who presided over Part A of this application. In her judgment, the judge briefly dealt with the interpretation of the wording contained in Section 23A of the Code and made the following comments in respect of the wording to which I had taken you to in paragraph, the judge says, quotes the section and then says the review ground set up by Gordhan is that he did not willfully mislead the National Assembly. The PP found that Gordhan honestly concealed the fact that at an Ambani meeting there was a Gupta present. Gordhan sets out that until today he cannot recall that the Gupta was present, but his chief of staff informed him in preparation for his evidence at the Zondo Commission that there was a Gupta present at that meeting. He, without an independent recollection thereof, disclosed this fact to the Commission. The EFF submitted that it matters not that Gordhan may not willfully have misled the legislature. An innocent mistake is sufficient. This is, of course, contrary to the wording of paragraph 23A of the Code, specifying that it must be done willfully. These facts Gordhan had established a prima facie right. Potterl J, with reference to the express wording employed in the Executive Ethics Code, thus held the view that what is required is that the misleading statement must have been done willfully and that an innocent mistake will therefore not fall short of the provision of 23A of the Executive Ethics Code. In her affidavit in the proceedings before us, the public protector strongly disagrees with the interpretation adopted by Potterl J, namely that willfulness is a requirement for the transgression of the Executive Ethics Code, but instead of merely recording her disagreement with the court's interpretation, she launched into a scathing, unwarranted, and personal attack on the integrity of the learned judge. She even goes as far as to accuse the learned judge of a gross misinterpretation of the code and of deliberately omitting words from the code. And then the paragraph that I took you to is quoted in the judgment. I'm not going to read it again. We've just been there. All right. Go down. Apart from the fact that the personal attack on the learned judge is shockingly inappropriate and unwarranted, the public protector's reading and interpretation of paragraph 23 of the Executive Ethics Code is wrong in law. And then we've dealt with this when we dealt with the Executive Ethics Code, but in the middle of the judgment it picks up to claim that Potterl J deliberately omitted the words inadvertently mislead from the actual code is simply astonishing. Besides being a public protector, Advocate Mkubani's office of this court owes it a duty to treat the court with necessary decorum. She not only committed an error of law regarding the code, but was contemptuous of the court and Judge Potterl personally. What makes this reprehensible conduct worse is that the remarks by Advocate Mkubani were made under oath when she ought to have known about the falsity thereof. This clearly held the possibility of misleading this court. This is conduct unbecoming of an advocate and officer of this court. She owes Judge Potterl an apology, and the Register of this Division is requested to send a copy of this judgment to the Legal Practice Council for consideration. In paragraph 63, it says, The public protector also bemoans the fact that Minister Gordhan has launched an attack on her integrity, which she labels as scandalous and made in an attempt to support a political crusade against her to mobilize political support for removal from office. Yet she has no qualms launching a blistering and personal attack on a judge of this division. To summarize, the evidence presented to the public protector does not support the conclusion that Mr. Gordhan willfully contravened the code. A conclusion to the contrary is incorrect. And then if you go to paragraph 284 of the judgment, go to PDF 715. The public protector deals with Mr. Gordhan's allegations of bias and ulterior purpose in her answering affidavit. She correctly points out that such allegations have far-reaching constitutional ramifications for the constitutional integrity, public trust, and proper constitutional functioning of the Office of the Public Protector. She, however, dismisses these allegations made by Minister Gordhan as unsubstantiated and labels it as an unconstitutional attempt to undermine the Office of the Public Protector. She further accuses Minister Gordhan as having mounted a bad faith attack on her and the Office of the Public Protector, which undermines the independence, impartiality, dignity, and effectiveness of the Public Protector. She also states that these insults have been made to harass and demean the constitutional significance of the work of the Public Protector. Although she submitted that the attacks and insults are not legitimate criticism which a court would tolerate if they were directed at it, the court, she herself has already pointed out, had no hesitation to mount such an attack against Pothril J of this division. And then in paragraph 290, the court concluded the nine grounds which I've taken you to before, on which a conclusion of bias was warranted. And one of those grounds is the public protector's unwarranted and slanderous attack on Pothril J. And one of the factors that was taken into account in respect of the adverse cost order, including the personal cost order, in the reasoning of the full bench in this matter, which you see from paragraphs 302, 303, and 304 of the judgment, which we've already dealt with. So that was one of the other grounds in dealing with it. And I'm next going to turn to the issue of recruitment. Chair, we're almost at lunchtime. Do you mind if we took it earlier and then I would run through the entire section after lunch, or if we could do that, Chair?
Okay.
Rather than me starting and stopping.
Okay, that's fine. Okay. All right. Thank you for giving these early breaks. That's fine. We'll take lunch, colleagues. Yeah, we'll take 5 minutes. Thank you.
Recording stopped.